So happy it's Thursday. Welcome, ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. Thanks for joining us. In studio with us today, Jim Lackey, Mortgage Concierge. That's at least what we're going to call him today. Mortgage Concierge. He specializes in out-of-the-box financing solutions. And doing a little bit of research on you, I found this on your website, and I thought this to be especially noteworthy. Specializes in filling the void left by institutions by introducing private sources of capital. Isn't that eloquent? That's what Jim does. So in case your wife ever asked, I remember you said last time, my wife found out what I did. Yeah. So there she goes.
Well, she wrote that, actually.
Oh, she wrote that. Well, perfect. Excellent. Well, good to her. Also do traditional loans, but really your specialization is the stuff that other people can't do.
Correct.
Also with us today, Pete Williams. He's a farmer's agent, specialized in, well, you've got a whole laundry list of insurance, auto, home, umbrella, life, renters, commercial, workers' comp. You've had your agency for 6 years, was voted a 5-star insurance agent, both in 2011 and 2012. Mm-hmm. What's up with 13? Guess we're working on it, right?
We're working on it.
We're working on it.
It'll
okay,
come
got
out
it.
In 14. Yeah.
All depends on the end of the show, right?
That's right.
That's right.
Voted as a top agent in home auto life by San Diego Award Program in 2012 and professional golfer right out of college. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah. Played a couple years and gave it a shot.
I mean, not that the insurance business isn't interesting. I'm sure that it is, but what am I saying? There may be a little bit more fun in playing golf all day.
Well, yeah.
Gentlemen, welcome. Thank you for both joining us. Topics today. Hard money loans. What is it, and why would somebody need one or get one as opposed to a traditional loan? And some examples of how that works, and Jim is certainly going to walk us through all that, as well as Pete has insurance tips for that every property investor should know. We're going to go over 6 of them that really are important for people that are holding and renting investment property. Isn't that right, Pete?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, perfect.
So, Jim, you know, out of the box financial solutions for people that may not necessarily fit within that corporate box of getting a loan these days. So I got to know, what exactly are we talking about here? Is it that you're trying to fill the gap for builders, or is it someone who's speccing a home themselves?
Well, there's all different scenarios. One of the reasons that people would borrow money from a private source is we can be pretty nimble. We can get things done very quickly. We just funded and closed a loan in 8 days, almost $3 million
wow.
Locally here in North County from the day the investor saw the property until the loan actually closed, 8 calendar days, which is pretty remarkable. So if you have a need for quick capital, that quick and institutional don't belong in the same sentence.
Right.
So private money fills that gap because it happens quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And then generally, depending upon what the purpose of the loan is, mm-hmm. if it's to buy a house, it's different than if you're going to buy an investment property or if you're going to build a house and sell it for a profit.
Well, before we get too far along, when you talk about closing fast, I hear that a lot, right? I mean, I see billboards where they promise closing in 21 days, this sort of thing. And now, more than ever, we're noticing agents are really pushing that contract to the letter and the date that are based on contingencies. So, you know, when people say, oh, we can close in 4 or 5 days, it used to mean nothing. But now, when you say that I can get someone out of a bind, let's just say you've got a $50,000 deposit on a house, and the seller says, look, you notice to perform on this thing, and you're stuck because the banks are, you know, looking at this thing twice, and they're, you know, taking their time on this process because their underwriting guidelines are a foot long.
Right.
You're saying you can come along and, you know, just make that happen. How is that?
Well, private investors just are more nimble. They can make decisions more quickly. We've done plenty of deals where we didn't require an appraisal. We look at it from a common sense standpoint and get an idea what this property is actually worth. Now, we, in most cases in the private world, we aren't going to lend as much as a bank will. We might only lend 60 or 65% of the value of the property, whereas a bank, I mean, FHA financing, you get 96.5% financing, but it takes a long time to get there. So we're not going to over-lever it, but if you get comfortable with the value of the property and decide how much you're willing to lend, you make a common sense decision and decide quickly.
Mm-hmm. So really there's no free lunch, right? We're talking about if you want out-of-the-box kind of financing, there's something you got to trade for it, right? So you're saying that the loan-to-value, meaning a borrower has to come in with like 35, 40%.
Correct.
So 35, 40% down, you're going to turn a blind eye to what?
Well, depends. It really depends a little bit on what the money's going to be used for. If you're going to buy that house to live in, even though we're private lenders, we still are regulated. We're still governed by federal and state law. So if somebody's going to buy a house to live in, we still have to underwrite that loan based on their income and what their monthly obligations are. And that's a lot of what takes the time when you're dealing with an institution. If it's an investment property, for example, we can move much more quickly on that. The other thing, there's a price of poker. A private investor that's going to fund this loan wants to get enough of a return to move the needle, so to speak. So, you know, in privately financed transactions, the interest rates are not what you read about in the paper. They're not what you...
Hit me. What do you got?
9, 10, 11%, sometimes more. It just depends on the nature of the property. But again, if it's an investment property and there's a spec construction project, for example, that's just part of the... That's part of the cost of putting that deal together. You know, there's a cost of the land, the cost of construction, cost of financing. Put all those together, sell it for a profit. It's just one of those components.
If I was specing a house, and we're just, if you're tuning in right now, we're on the line with Jim Lackey with Mortgage Concierge, basically filling the gap with that hard money loan, right? Those out-of-the-box type of loans. His website is jimlackeyassociates.com. You can reach him directly at 858-699-2280. So, Jim, I'm specing a house, okay? I go to the bank. They say, look, it's going to take forever to get this thing, and I want to get my guys working on this thing. I need money now to start the operation. I come to you. Is there a prepayment penalty with this type of product? Because if you stick me with a 10% interest rate, I'm going to want out of that thing.
Usually construction loans are short-term in nature anyway. They're usually written for a year. Maybe there's an extension option of 6 months or so. But the idea if you're going to build a spec project is that you build it, you sell it. When you sell it, our loan gets paid off. So usually there isn't a prepayment penalty because it's just going to take a certain amount of time to build the house anyway.
You've used that word spec a couple times. Why don't you explain to us what you mean by spec project?
Spec, yeah, thanks, Ryan. Spec is essentially just short for speculative, which the lenders, the banking world, would call it a for sale project, meaning I'm going to build it and I'm going to sell it to somebody as opposed to so banks don't like to do spec construction as a rule, for sale construction as a rule, because they don't like the fact that they get paid when the property gets sold. They want to have another, what they call a secondary support for repayment. So generally, if a bank does a loan, they're going to want you to personally guarantee the loan. And in order for you to provide a personal guarantee, you have to have a strong enough financial statement for that guarantee to really mean something. Candidly, a lot of developers over the years, the last several years, have been challenged. Their financial statements don't look quite as good
challenged.
As they did.
It's a good way to put it.
Yeah, they're just not... okay, train wrecks, the truth be told. So if a bank wants a personal guarantee and your financial statement isn't strong enough to guarantee it, you're basically out of the banking world altogether.
Right.
Private lenders, on the other hand, aren't going to require a personal guarantee as a rule. They're going to underwrite the loan based on making sure that the borrower has enough cash in the deal, and then we lend the balance and we get paid when the property sells. So our security is purely the property.
Mm-hmm. Well, I actually like the fact that there's no personal guarantee, or it's not guaranteed that there's a personal guarantee, because I frankly have seen a few people get themselves caught up in personally guaranteeing things, and then when things don't go the right way, they really got to pony up.
Yeah, I guess our attitude, just to maybe editorialize just a little bit, is that as lenders, our recourse is the property. So when you make a lending decision, you're basing it on the asset that you're lending against, and if that loan doesn't get repaid for whatever reason, your recourse is to take the property.
Foreclose.
Exactly. That's the way it's always worked, the way it's supposed to work. So to have a secondary layer of support, another layer of financial assuredness for the lender, probably okay for a bank. That's what they require. But in our world, I think the way we mitigate the risk is we don't overlend. We're not going to lend 80%, 90% of what the finished value is. We're going to lend 60, 65% of what the finished value is, and we feel like that's enough of a cushion to protect our loan interest.
So if I hear you correctly, institutional lenders, they're loaning money to people, their loan-to-value is lower, but when they do so, they're looking for the long-term return on their investment. So they loan this money to people, people make payments for 30 years, or they sell this mortgage to Wall Street on the back end, they're making money on that side.
Mm-hmm.
Where you come in is that, you know, some of these banks are not looking at these types of products, and you're coming in and saying, look, we're going to get you to a level. It's going to be a little bit more expensive, well, let's say quite a bit more expensive than traditional lending, and it may be something that people are going to get out of quicker. So you guys are in, get the job done, and most of the time people are getting out.
Well, that's an excellent point and a good observation, because if you look at it from the standpoint of the duration of the loan, even though the cost of private capital is more expensive, it really is very short term. It's 12, 18, 24 months. So even though it may be higher than what a bank rate would be if you could get a bank loan, it's not like you have to live with this loan for 30 years. You're only going to have it for a short period of time. So the cost of it, the way I advise clients to look at it, is the cost of private money. Look at the delta between the two. Look at the increment between what bank financing would cost if you could get it and private financing, because it's really the premium that you pay for private financing and the ability to move quickly and get things done.
Okay, Jim, you know, when we come back, I'd like to figure out a few more things. One is that where are you getting your sources from? And I understand that you're also looking for people to actually participate in this loaning to get this rate of return. So you're working kind of like for the borrower and working for people that are looking to get a better rate of return on their money.
Correct.
So when we come back, we'll talk a bit more about that. And, you know, I really just want to get a sense of, you know, how this whole thing is coming together, what your forecast is you're seeing with all these builders. I understand you were at a conference this morning with a number of builders. Seems to be that they're stepping it up. When we come back.
Welcome back. So happy it's Thursday. ESPN 1700 AM. It's the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
Big Mac David McKelvin.
And myself, Ryan White. We just heard from our mortgage concierge, Jim Lackey, a little bit about his out-of-the-box financing, and we will get back to that. But before we do, we're going to talk to Pete Williams. We're going to find out everything, well, just about everything, you might need to know about getting property insurance for the investor. Mm-hmm. So just to set the stage, I buy a home or a condo, could be, mm-hmm. and I don't intend to live in it. I intend to rent it to somebody else. That's generally what we're talking about, right?
Right, exactly, yeah.
And I would assume that there's a whole other set of insurance tips for those properties you do intend to live in.
Right.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we're just focusing on non-owner-occupied property.
Correct.
So Jim, you mentioned spec homes a lot, and because of a spec home, it's speculatory, meaning that they're not going to live there, they're for sale. And I think that plays well into maybe your analogy here of number five, when you talk about what if I can't rent it out right away and it'll be sitting vacant.
Mm-hmm.
And although your spec home, let's hope, is not sitting vacant very long, but in theory, nobody's living in there while they're building, at least let us hope. So how do things play out if I have a vacant home that, let's say it's already built, and nobody's living in it? What are the insurance things I should know about that?
Well, the first thing, if you know it's going to sit there vacant for at least 60 days, it'd be best to get what's called a vacant policy right away. If it's going to be sitting there for less than 60 days, a homeowner's policy will, you know, you can put one in place, but it's only going to cover 60 days vacancy. That's it. So if you know it's going to be sitting there vacant, I would get a vacant policy. And luckily, Farmers owns another company called Foremost that has a specific policy just for that.
Vacant homes.
For vacant homes. And really what it's going to cost is, or what it's going to cover, you know, things if somebody falls down on the property, you've got liability coverage. If you've got a squatter in there and they damage the property, you pay a deductible, you get everything fixed. Where a homeowner's policy, after 60 days, it's void. So
really?
you're gonna have no coverage on a homeowner's policy if the home sits there vacant for 60 days or more.
So my renters move out. I can't get it re-rented for 60 days. In that instance, I'm essentially uncovered.
Exactly, yeah.
Wow, is that common that people go out and get another policy?
Not usually.
Not common.
It's not common.
People don't know.
I don't think people know that there is a policy specifically for vacant homes.
Got it. Got it. Okay. Well, that's good to know. So, again, the home is not vacant. It's not your primary residence. Go out and get a policy specific for those properties that have been vacant or will be vacant for more than 60 days.
That's right, yeah.
And what duration is that policy good for?
It's infinite.
Infinite.
I mean, yeah, you can set it up to where I've got one. We put it in place 2 years ago. It's still sitting there vacant, and she still has coverage. Obviously, it costs more than a homeowner's policy. It's about three times as expensive. Because there is a lot more liability. You don't have somebody who's in the house. You know, if there's a water leak, no one may catch it for months. So that's why it costs a lot more. You know, if you live in the home, you're there every day, you're going to see if there's, you know, electrical fire, you know, and get it taken care of. If there's a water leak, for example, you know, you're going to get that taken care of right away, where a vacant home could sit there for months with, you know, without anybody seeing that there's anything wrong with it.
So my father owns a home that has been a rental property for 20-some years. When the people eventually move out, I'm sure it's going to need some substantial renovation. In that time frame, it's going to be vacant for easily more than 60 days.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say that I know that, and I go out and get this vacant home policy. Then someone moves in 4 months from now. Mm-hmm. Do I get some kind of proration for that amount of time?
You set it up on a month-to-month basis.
Oh, month-to-month.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
Got
so it's going to continue on. You know, you can do a year-long policy for the vacant home, but if you stop it after 4 months, you just pay 4 months.
I see. Yeah. So you can prorate it.
Right. So it's not going to lock you in, you know, for a certain amount of time.
We're on with Pete Williams. He is a Farmers Insurance agent. His website is farmersagent.com/P Williams 4. One more time. farmersagent.com/P Williams 4. Additionally, the helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. We're talking about his ebook on 6 insurance tips that every property investor should know, specifically set up for non-owner occupied properties. And we talked about a vacant policy additionally. And again, you have 6 tips here. Now, what number one here, if I'm purchasing an investment home, what type of policy should I have? And is a regular homeowner's policy good enough?
Right. And a lot of times people put a regular homeowner's policy on it thinking that it's going to cover something that's non-owner occupied. Unfortunately, as soon as it's non-owner occupied, that homeowner's policy is now void. So you need to have a separate type of policy. There are really two types of policies when it comes to investment homes that are non-owner occupied. And these are single family homes. We can talk about condos in just a minute. But you've got a dwelling policy. It's called a DP3 policy. And the three just stands for the number. There's a DP1, 2, and 3. There are different coverages that come with each one. We do DP3 policies. It's got a very broad coverage, you know, so it's going to cover a little bit of personal property. If the owner has, say, you know, a refrigerator, washer and dryer, stove, things like that, you know, if the house burns down, they don't need to go out and buy those things again. It's going to be covered under the policy. It's also going to cover, obviously, the structure of the home and any upgrades that are included. It's also going to cover liability. So if their tenants invite some people over and somebody falls down and gets injured, this policy will kick in and actually cover that person's injuries. So it's a great thing to have as an investor. That's really why you need it, to protect yourself. And then obviously it's going to cover, you know, the fire, the water claims, things like that. So it's kind of a homeowner's policy, but it's specifically covering, you know, non-owner occupied residents. Then there's another one. The DP3 policies go up to $500,000 for reconstruction on a home. If you go above that, you need what's called a landlord protector policy, and that goes up to $750,000. Landlord protector is very similar to it. There's a couple different coverages. You know, I don't know how detailed we want to get, but basically that's going to cover bigger homes, a landlord protector policy.
Sounds like the difference is the amount of coverage, $500,000 versus $750,000.
For the most part, yeah.
Well, San Diego is a great place to live. There's a lot of people that come here seasonally. So they're going to be gone 6 months of the year. Do they get that owner-occupied property policy for 6 months and then roll into that non-owner occupied policy for the other 6 months?
That's a good question. Yeah, we do have a lot of clients who are here for 6 months and then they'll either rent it out or it'll sit vacant for those other 6 months. And we do switch the policy over, you know,
every six months or whatever.
Right, every six
wow.
months. And it protects them. And once we sit down and we educate them on the type of policy that they should have, they understand the importance of it. And it doesn't take long to switch it over. I mean, it's a very simple process.
So, you know, out of curiosity, I'm thinking to myself, you know, how are they really going to know, right? I mean, I've left for 3 months, and, you know, I get away with regular owner-occupied type of policy. But, you know, then again, it dawns on me that, you know, what if there is a fire, right? Fire department busts in there. They water everything down, and they look around like, there's nothing here. Mm-hmm. You guys come in to do your inspection to pay it out, and all of a sudden you're like, well, look, this is an owner-occupied policy. There's no furniture here. This is odd. Is that what happens?
It happens. Yeah, it definitely happens. And, you know, that's where the insurance company does an investigation, and they may or may not cover that claim, you know, because as soon as you moved out, you know, and it sat there for 60 days, technically, you know, ouch. Some insurance companies may still cover it, some may not. But obviously with the economy, most insurance companies are struggling. They are a business. And, you know, if they don't have to technically cover a claim, a lot of times they don't.
Mm-hmm. We're on with Pete Williams. He's a Farmers insurance agent. His website, farmersagent.com/pwilliams4. farmersagent.com/pwilliams4. Or the helpline, 888-551-2593. That's the number, 888-551-2593. When we come back, we're going to get a little bit deeper with Jim here and going to give us some examples of some of his hard money financing. And still ahead, we only got through two of the six insurance tips that every property investor should know. I want to talk about the difference between a single family and a condo in terms of insurance, all ahead of us when we come back.
Welcome back to ESPN Radio. Your host,
Ryan White,
and myself, David McKelvin. We just heard from Pete Williams, Farmers Insurance agent, talking about vacant properties and the difference between owner-occupied policies and policies that you need based on the fact that the house is going to be vacant for more than 60 days and why you should be concerned about that sort of thing. But we've actually got Jim Lackey, mortgage concierge, well, in the house today to talk about out-of-the-box financing, essentially hard money loans. You know, you're here, you make a difference when the banks are underwriting processes are taking too long and their guidelines may be too stringent for a lot of people out there.
Correct.
And, you know, investors can see opportunity if they could just bridge that loan. So that's really where you come in. You
correct.
Know, you've got, I understand, individuals that invest in the company to make a great rate of return. Right. So,
well, they invest in individual transactions. So it's not a fund or it's not an investment in my company. It's individual loans are funded by individual investors.
So without getting too detailed in that, you're essentially able to create income for people that is related to real estate, but not necessarily out there flipping property and that sort of thing.
Exactly right. We're just basically like a bank, except that we charge more. And so as a result, the investor makes more. And the borrower gets the money they need on a timely basis to get them to their end game, to their exit.
And so you mentioned also that you have one closing technically tomorrow, right?
Yeah, we actually had a loan that signed loan documents this morning at 10:30. So it'll record tomorrow morning. And once we get confirmation of recording, the loan will officially close, escrow will close. And it's an interesting one because it's what I'm seeing a lot more of today, and that is because of the shortage of housing that's available, that means there's not a lot of new product that's on the market because construction financing has been difficult to get. So you combine the lack of available existing homes with the lack of new homes, it's creating an opportunity for builders and developers to find property and design spec homes and then sell them. So this particular builder, who actually is a transplant from Canada. It's a 40-year-old general contractor, that 40-year-old company, I should say, that's been in San Diego for 4 years, bought a piece of property in Pacific Beach, which is one of the communities that we love to lend in, anything close to the big blue thing. We like those. We like that real estate. And he's building three detached row homes, for sale, for spec. And we're doing a loan there to help him bridge the gap to be able to build those homes. So he gets them finished and gets them sold, and the investor on that will earn a substantial return.
Right. So that you got a builder, right? He finds this lot. He puts together a financial package on it. Says, look, I buy the lot for X. I build it for X. I can sell it for Y. And now I go to financing, and the banks are like, you know what? We're not ready for you. So really what we've got right now is a supply and demand problem.
Right.
Right. The supply is very low. The demand is enormous for real estate. And these banks have not yet caught up to underwriting processes that allow the money to flow to these contractors to build these spec homes or build these homes for people. And so you're talking about builders and getting loans for those. And frankly, also individuals. You know, you're blessed. You've got a piece of land. You want to build a house on it. You know, you're going to build your dream home. And now the underwriting processes with the banks, maybe they don't work.
Well, I see that. In fact, I see it more and more, and particularly because the movement in the institutional world as far as cost of financing, those rates are going up. And if somebody waits to be able to build, if they wait another year or 2 years to be able to build, who knows what the permanent financing rates are going to look like at that time. So there is a sense of urgency to get things built now for an individual that wants to build a home for himself. The same is true on this for the spec builder. The spec builder wants to get those homes built and get them sold while the institutional financing
sure,
those
is
buyers
there.
Is at least is there and
for
is
sure.
and somewhat affordable.
So you said earlier that one of the underwriting guidelines is that it's either 40 or 45% loan to value.
No, actually, it's more like 60 to 65% loan to value. So that essentially means that my borrower needs to have 35 to 40% of the cost in cash because I don't want to, I'm not going to lend them more. I don't like to push the envelope because I have to protect my investor and reduce the risk to the investor. So when I do those kinds of loans, I want to make sure that my borrower's got skin in the game, is the expression. And a substantial enough amount
sure.
of skin in the game that they don't walk away if things aren't going well.
Well, in regards to the underwriting processes and trying to figure out, you know, how people are going to qualify for your loan, is that skin in the deal, that 35-40% that they have to put down, is it okay if that's a loan?
Well, it depends if we're talking about somebody that's going to build a home for themselves to live in versus the example of the builder that's going to build a spec home. If it's the latter scenario, I don't really care where that money comes from. I don't care where the 30 or 35 or 40% cash comes from. It can be a gift. It doesn't really matter to me.
Right, because you're going to take first position
correct.
On this. And if something goes wrong, you don't care who's behind you on title.
Well, and they wouldn't even be on title technically. It's just cash. It's just equity that's in the deal. It's just, you know, the borrower's equity essentially in the form of cash.
What are some of the other underwriting qualifications people have to get your loan?
Well, again, it depends. I hate to keep saying it depends. It depends on whether it's a spec construction loan or whether it's somebody that's going to live in the house themselves. If somebody's going to live in the home themselves, they're usually going to have about 20%, maybe 25% of the cost of the land, the cost of construction, and the cost of financing. So there's no free lunch even in the conventional world of getting a construction loan for a home that you're going to live in yourself. You still have to have cash in the deal.
I think what you're really saying is don't wait, right? I mean, if you're thinking that this might be something you're going to need, call you. You have all the answers, but you don't know exactly how the flow is going to go. You know, you say, okay, you're looking for possibly a bridge loan, a hard money loan. So let me ask you a question. Is it something that you're speccing or is it something you're going to live in?
Correct. Those are two good questions.
And then it goes from there.
Right.
Okay. Does it make a difference in terms of interest rate if it's owner-occupied versus a spec home?
It does, because oftentimes if it's going to be owner-occupied, if it's a solid borrower, that's oftentimes a scenario where I can, if they have time, I can actually direct them towards a handful of institutions that will do that construction loan and also do the permanent financing. But if it's a spec deal, as I mentioned earlier, the banks don't like speculative projects without a strong secondary source of repayment other than just the sale of the property exclusively.
So traditionally, these banks are loaning money based on a very low loan to value with a, you know, client that's got good income, it's got good tax returns, good job, this sort of thing. High criteria is pretty high. And then they're turning around, they're selling these loans on the back end in a lot of cases. I think there's a disclosure within the guidelines that say there's a 98% chance we're going to sell this thing. So, you know, one day you're making a mortgage payment to, let's just say, Bank X, and the next week you're making a payment to Bank Y, and you're, you know, wondering why is that the case, but, you know, you signed it in the document. So is this something that you guys are going to hold on to, or are you doing the same thing?
Well, remember, these loans, the private loans in particular, are short-term. They're not really intended to be, you know, somebody's going to pay 9, 10, 11, 12% interest for our loan. They're not going to want to have that loan for 30 years. They're going to want it as a bridge to get from point A to point B. They're only going to have it for about a year. And at that point, the loan generally ends up being refinanced into something more conventionally. So oftentimes we get involved in situations where the borrower can't qualify for a bank loan today. Maybe they've had some credit challenges in the last few years. They had a short sale. They had a bankruptcy. They had something bad happen to them in their recent financial past, and they can't really qualify for a bank loan today. But over the course of a year or 2 years, some of those things kind of fall off the radar. Their credit score goes up. They now look acceptable to a bank, and they can refinance at that point. So our loan's never going to be a long-term loan. We would never do a privately financed mortgage, for example, for 30 years.
So is that mean there's a balloon involved somewhere down the road? Or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, so and they generally, the loans are typically interest only. They're 12, 18, 24 months with a balloon payment at the end. And, I mean, they can vary, and the terms can vary. What usually doesn't vary that much is the rate of return that the investor is going to require in order for him to do the loan. So that's that 9, 10, 11%.
Okay,
it doesn't really matter if it's going to be amortized or if it's interest only.
So just so I'm clear, someone borrows $1 million through your process to build a project. They keep it for month one. They make a $10,000 mortgage payment, which is interest only, meaning month one and they pay it off, they still owe $1 million.
That's right.
So any payments that are made are strictly just to the investor interest side of things. In the end, the mortgage is still exactly the same when you borrowed it. There's no reduction whatsoever.
Correct. Unless somebody has a lot of cash flow and they don't want to do an interest-only loan and they want to do an amortized loan. But typically, that's not what I see.
If you're just tuning in right now, we are on the line with Jim Lackey, mortgage concierge, hard money guy, lender out of the box, 858-699-2280. That's his direct line, 858-699-2280. You know, there's a lot of things people can do with this. What we're really talking about is just now there's a new tool. I mean, it's not necessarily new, but it's rediscovered right now where people are looking at, well, let's just say that I'm seeing mortgages difficult to get. I can't get the amount of money out of my property to go out and buy some of this other real estate that I see going up. You could do a hard money refinance.
Mm-hmm.
The people can pull out more than normal cash and go out and invest in some of this real estate and be a part of this appreciating real estate market if they should choose so.
Yeah, just did one 2 weeks ago. Loaned a couple $100,000 to a guy who had bought a house in Carlsbad, wanted to buy an investment property.
Well, hold that thought for a second. When we come back, I want to dive into some real down-to-earth organic situations where people have actually used this tool to make money when we come back.
Welcome back. ESPN 1700 AM, the Real Estate Radio Hour with your host,
David McKelvin,
and myself, Ryan White. Jim Lackey, our resident mortgage concierge, just finished up with some unique examples of his out-of-the-box financing solutions. His website, jimlackeyassociates.com. That's the website, jimlackeyassociates.com. We're going to switch back to Pete Williams and continue going over his 6 insurance tips that every property investor should know. And these are designed specifically for non-owner-occupied properties. We talked about 2 of them already, and this is one that really interests me because, well, homes are expensive to buy around here, and I find that usually they don't cash flow if they tend to get over about $700,000, which means that condos are what I've been investing in to put renters in and, well, essentially non-owner occupy. Mm-hmm. And that being said, what are the different types of policies for single-family home versus condos?
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit about the single-family home, so we talked about the DP3 policies and the landlord protector policies, depending on the value of the reconstruction. On townhouses, there's really two types of policies that we can do on townhouses or condos. I guess, you know, I use those terms interchangeably. I know they're a little bit different. But a condo, you're going to do a townhouse or a condo rented out to others, so which is different than just a regular HO6 policy that we all know about.
Oh, we know a lot about HO6s. Yeah.
So it's different than that in that, you know, it takes into account the liability. Same thing. You've got a little bit of personal property coverage versus, you know, say 25 or 50,000, you know, that the person has in there. So the investor's not going to, you know, furnish the place. Unless they do, then we can also cover that as well. And then if you need to cover the structure, so typically, you know, a condo policy just covers walls in. If you need to cover the structure, then we're back at a DP3 policy. So the same thing that we could use for a single family home, we can use it on a condo if we need to insure the structure.
So I pay $330-some a month in HOA fees. Theoretically, and it's my understanding, should this thing burn down, they will put the structure back, but it'll be floorless and kitchenless. Is that correct? And then that's where I get the internal policy, or am I covered with my homeowners association policy to get the floor in the kitchen?
That's a good question, and that is a misconception that a lot of people have, that the HOA is going to rebuild everything. Some HOAs actually do have a policy that covers some internal, you know, upgrades and things like that, so they might put in a floor. You might have, say, $10,000 per unit that they'll put in, but obviously that's not going to rebuild
internally.
The kitchen. Right, walls in, yeah. That's not going to cover, you know,
nothing.
Rebuilding the kitchen or, you know, doing the bathrooms. So a lot of times people say, oh, my HOA is going to cover it all, and they don't even get a policy. Now, obviously, you know, you're required to have an HO6 policy if you purchase a condo. But on a condo that's rented, you're still going to want to have the same what's called building property coverage. So that's going to cover walls in. So to answer
walls
your question,
in.
Yeah. So you still need to have that coverage, building property.
So it burns down. HOA puts up the studs,
mm-hmm.
maybe the drywall. We could argue about who does the drywall, who
right,
doesn't.
Right.
But internally, I'm going to have no kitchen, no bathroom, a hole in the ground where a toilet used to be, and it is the HO6 policy that you guys provide that would add essentially the ability to live there.
Right, right, exactly, yeah. So the main four things it's going to cover, cupboards, countertops, sinks, and toilets. That's kind of the main thing. And then if there's any upgrades to flooring, a lot of times the HOAs will put in the basic flooring that was there originally. So like mm-hmm. if it's built in 1975, you might get some shag carpet put back in there.
Well, the ultimate takeaway here is that $333 a month I'm paying the HOA is not covering full insurance. It's not going to be re-rentable or rehabitable once they come back and do whatever the insurance policy is covering.
Right. That's exactly right. Yeah. They're just walls out, basically. You know, they're just covering the structure. That's it. Nothing inside.
And I kind of think that the condo non-owner occupied policies are fairly inexpensive, aren't they?
They are. They range, you know, depends on how big the condo is, how many bedrooms, what's the square footage, if it's been upgraded. But I'd say between $350 and $500 a year.
It's not terribly expensive.
Yeah.
Got it. $50 a month.
Does it get less expensive if you have other properties with you, meaning like an umbrella policy? Is that what they call it, where you might have your primary residence, a vacation home, and an investment property all with the same?
Yeah, that's a good question. Typically, insurance companies only give discounts when it's owner-occupied. So if you've got a home and auto, for example, those give each other a discount. As soon as you've got something that's non-owner-occupied, it kind of stands by itself and doesn't help out with discounts.
Got it.
No, isn't that nice? Yeah. Okay, number three, if I'm making renovations to the property, is there a special type of policy that I need? And I suppose the amount of renovations is going to be substantially important, as, you know, I've seen a lot of homes you drive by and there's one wall remaining and they're calling it a remodel. But mm-hmm. we'll get to that next. But let's assume it's a simple, not terribly complicated renovation, like a new kitchen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then you're going to use a policy that's called a builder's risk policy. And this is basically, so I've actually got a client who we've had his home insured for the last 3 or 4 years, and he is actually expanding his master bedroom, you know, making it about 200 square feet bigger or so. So what we're actually going to do is cancel his homeowner's policy, put a builder's risk policy in place, and the builder's risk policy, you really have a couple options. One option is to cover the existing structure. So if you're just adding on, for example, you know, remodeling, we cover the existing structure in the builder's risk policy. Or the other option is, you know, if it's basically a teardown, not necessarily a teardown, but if it's, you know, you got one wall remaining, there's really no existing structure that you need to insure. So the other option is to just cover the new construction. So for him, though, we are insuring the existing structure, and we're also covering what's going to be added on to it.
But I think what's most important here is that if I'm living in a home and everything's going along fine and I decide I want to remodel it, if I do not go out and get the builder's risk policy, the current homeowner's policy I have may not cover things that occur while I'm during this new renovation stage.
Exactly, yeah. So, you know, when you've got builders coming in and out of the house, you just never know. Somebody could fall down, get injured. A lot of times that's not going to be covered under a homeowner's policy. And when the insurance company does a little bit of research and figures out that you did a renovation without alerting them, you know, and going out and finding a new policy, kind of go back to what we talked about a little bit ago, that sometimes they don't cover those claims because technically they don't have to.
I can see that. What if I'm tearing down the house completely? And you touched on that a little bit, but start over, mm-hmm. build new.
Yep. Then you're going to use what's called a course of construction policy. So it's different than a builder's risk. Builder's risk is going to be remodeling or maybe adding on to the existing structure. Course of construction really is either new construction, you know, something from the ground up, or a tear down. So you're tearing it down, and you know, the example you used of having one wall left, I would say that would probably be more of a course of construction policy because there's really nothing left. But really when you're keeping the same foundation, then you'd use a course of construction policy versus a builder's risk.
It really seems like just about every time I turn around, I need to get a hold of my insurance agent to determine if I'm moving out and how long I leave for, or if I'm renovating and to what extent I'm leaving for, all to determine if I'm covered. Do mm-hmm. you have people that are forever in transition?
I've got some clients that, you know, they spend 3 months here. I have some clients that are on an exchange every 6 months. So somebody moves into their house for 6 months. They move to somebody else's house. They're from France originally. So, you know, they find these homes in France. They move there for 6 months. The French people move here for 6 months. So we're switching out their policy constantly. We've got quite a few. And you know, David brought it up. They're, you know, here in San Diego, people are here in the summer. They might not be here in the winter, you know, vice versa. So there are people moving constantly. And that's where, you know, really having an agent that informs you of the different types of policies so that you can properly insure yourself is crucial.
Makes sense. We're on the line here with Pete Williams, Farmers Agent. His website, farmersagent.com/P Williams 4. That's the website, farmersagent.com/P Williams 4. We just went over 6 insurance tips that every property investor should know, non-owner-occupied property tips. Maybe next time we'll go over owner-occupied property information. One more time, Pete Williams, Farmers Agent, farmersagent.com/P Williams 4, and it's the number 4. Also, Jim Lackey, Mortgage Concierge. If you've got a loan that you can't get done anywhere else, he's your guy. His website, JimLackeyAssociates.com. That's the website, JimLackeyAssociates.com. And the helpline, 888-551-2593. If you'd like to talk to any of our guests, again, 888-551-2593. Coming up next, Tim Stromble with Sports Court. Talk to you next week.